picking him up.
Lonnie Allen.
And carrying him. And answering the phone. Answering the phone. So when I went by to see him last year, I said, can he remember? She said, I don't think so. I said, I'll ask him. I owe him about $2 million. I said, I owe you any money? No, no. I said, he's sick. He's
sick. That was Dick Gregory just last year in 2016. The legendary comedian, civil rights activist, died Saturday at the age of 84 in Washington, D.C. Last night, at a performance at Radio City Music Hall, Dave Chappelle ended his show by calling Dick Gregory a giant and saying he wouldn't be here today if Gregory had not been there before him. Happy Eclipse, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
The time is 5 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Yon Mini Storage, offering storage for home or business, short-term or long-term, in any size, from a closet to a garage. Yon Mini Storage is located at 3055 Northwest Yon Avenue in Portland. More info and reservations at 503-827-3900 and yonministorage.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, about 1,000 people attend the Eclipse Hate Rally in Portland on Saturday.
Dick Gregory, one of our country's greatest political comedians, has died at the age of 84.
And we have a report on last weekend's 26th annual Seattle Hemp Fest, the world's largest marijuana legalization protestival.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 21st, 2017. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. Events last week in Charlottesville have triggered mass solidarity movements in cities across the U.S., including the city of Portland. On Friday evening, at least 1,000 people gathered at the Portland waterfront for the Eclipse Hate Solidarity with Charlottesville rally. KBOO's Fox Wild, Linda Olson Osterlund, and Ray Bodwell were there and have this report. We need to warn listeners that the following audio segment contains strong language.
Well, over 1,000 people gathered in Tom McCall Waterfront Park this past Friday for the Eclipse Hate Solidarity with Charlottesville rally. The peaceful event, which was organized by Portland's Resistance, began with speeches at the Salmon Street Fountain at 5:30. For nearly 2 hours, organizers and activists urged the crowd to take action against the racists, misogynists, and xenophobes that have been emboldened since the election of Donald Trump.
This is the time to be serious. We have brothers and sisters being attacked in this country, and this isn't just a Facebook check-in. We are under attack. Minorities, people of color, transgendered individuals, you need to act now.
Several of the speakers shared stories of their own painful examples of hate speech here in Portland.
I've been in Portland since 1981, and I've only had like three incidents where I would call a nigger. Hate hurts everyone, not just the person it's directed at.
But the primary call was for unity and action in the face of hate.
Pretty much all of y'all are strangers to each other, right? Until later today when we'll be something different. We'll be a movement. Or maybe we already are.
While the speeches were going on, organizers moved through the crowd handing out leaflets and informing attendees about upcoming opportunities to fight racism and fascism.
I'm Jamie Partridge. I'm an organizer with Portland Stands United Against Hate. And we endorsed this mobilization. We were responsible for a couple of mobilizations against the white nationalists who gathered on June 4th here in town and on August 6th. And again, I'm passing out flyers for their next mobilization on September 10th, in which they're bringing Confederate Monument defenders to Portland.
International Socialist Organization,
right.
And we organize at Portland State University every week. And we're having a public meeting August 31st at 7 o'clock, and it's about socialist strategies of how to fight the right. So we are just looking for how to organize and make sure that we know this is going to be an ongoing fight, a long fight ahead of us, and we just want to make sure that we are coming together with other people on the left and building a strong united front.
Many attendees stopped to add their signatures to a large white banner that read, quote, PDX stands with Seville, while others moved through the crowd carrying homemade signs with messages such as Black Lives Matter or Love Trump's Hate. The president's refusal to categorically condemn the Nazis and white supremacists who organized the Charlottesville rally and his support for statues honoring Confederate war heroes were also targeted by the crowd. After the speeches, demonstrators marched through downtown Portland before crossing the Hawthorne Bridge and heading north on Grand Avenue. Throughout the march, there were frequent chants of No KKK, No Fascist USA, No Trump. They then crossed back over the Morrison Bridge, where they held a silent vigil for 4 minutes before returning to the Salmon Spring Fountain a little after 9 p.m. The Portland Police Bureau maintained a very low profile with only 2 officers in evidence during the rally, and no incidents or arrests were reported. As the crowd broke, there were many conversations about further rallies and the need to stay engaged in the fight against hate. The crowd's frustration with the president's refusal to condemn white supremacists may have best been summarized by the hand-lettered sign that read, quote, I can't believe I have to make a sign that says Stop the Nazis. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
Eclipse Hate, a rally that was held on Saturday at Waterfront Park, saw about 1,000 people from many different organizations and diverse backgrounds turn out to show support. KBOO reporter Fox Wild brings us these comments from some of the attendees.
Portland Resistance decided to put together an event in solidarity with the people of Charlottesville and sort of the whole events that went down in Charlottesville last weekend, and also the people of Portland and all people affected by the rise of white supremacy. So we're holding this event. We're going to do a march. We have a bunch of speakers. And over here where I am, there is a banner and a bunch of small signs, like an art area where people can sign a banner, make a message for Heather Heyer, the people of Charlottesville, and things like that.
I'm non-theist clergy, and I came out tonight to oppose racism, fascism, and white supremacy in Portland and across the United States. We're surrounded by a lot of people who are supporting justice and equality and love right now. And I'm hoping that it doesn't escalate into something worse, but it probably won't, because I just see a lot of peace.
The Portland Police Bureau monitored the event, but maintained a strict hands-off policy. That prompted local organizations, including some anarchist collectives, to step in and provide security for the event. A member of one local collective who wished to remain anonymous said he was happy the event was peaceful and constructive. Another collective member, who also wishes to remain anonymous, had this to say.
I think it's great that people are here right now. I think the vigil that happened last week, the day after, where 600 people were at City Hall, was inspiring. I think people are rightly angry right now, and I think in the same similar way that you could see how Portland knew how serious it was after the people got stabbed on the Max. I think nationally now that's translated that everyone, across the U.S. and even across the world knows like fascism is getting these people, the far right people, like they're serious. They're getting stronger. Trump's pouring gasoline on the fire. fire, that we need to all unite, you know, across the political spectrum. Anyone who's against fascists need to figure out how to organize to stop these people and demoralize them and get them to go away. And I think this is so helpful because I think the only way to do that is to bring out masses of people and have mass movements to confront the fascists and the far right. I don't think it'll be, like, I think we need to figure out how to defend ourselves, but I don't think just street fighting alone is enough to stop them. I really think the only way is to bring out masses of people. So this gives me hope. I think we need to just figure out how to keep the momentum going, get people organized. I'm glad to see so many people out here today. I think a lot of people, the people that I've been talking to are serious, want to get organized, understand the need to do something. Like, I think what we're fighting against is, like, a lot of the liberal media, even Tina Fey in her comic bit that you might have seen, like, she was saying, don't go out. I think that the fact that people aren't listening to that, they're saying that's not a good strategy. We do need to go out. We do need to mobilize. I think that, like, you can see that people are hearing that. I hope that anyone who is listening to those messages, like, sees what's happening tonight and realizes that, no, we do need to go out. Like, people want you out. The way to fight this is to go out to the streets and to organize en masse. You can't just stay home. They're not going to get weaker if you stay home. So I think people are hearing that, and we just need to keep talking about that and putting that forward as an alternative.
During the march, a moment of silence for the victims of Charlottesville was observed on the Morrison Bridge. The Eclipse Hate demonstration peacefully concluded at 9 o'clock that evening.
In response to the opioid overdose epidemic, King County, Washington plans to open the first supervised consumption facility in the United States. Opponents to this move have filed an initiative in King County, I-27, that's EYE-27, that would block the county from providing these basic harm reduction services. To find out more, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Bob Wood, MD, a public health expert in Seattle who's with Protect Public Health.
I've come together with a bunch of other people who are concerned about this initiative, I-27 in King County. King County and Seattle went through a very exhaustive process recently to review what options there were to address the opioid epidemic that everybody knows about, and the untimely overdose deaths that generally occur to young people. In King County alone, we have 200 overdose deaths a year. In the state of Washington, about 1,000. And this process that the county and the city went through reviewed all of the different kinds of prevention programs and treatment programs and recommendations that people have had to address opioid abuse, and ultimately came up with 8 different recommendations. And only one of the recommendations at the end was that the county should establish 2 sites like the one up in Vancouver, which is called InSight. That program has been studied exhaustively, has about 30 publications that in peer-reviewed journals, including the New England Journal of Medicine and The Lancet, and it is widely believed to be reducing the number of overdose deaths as people's injections are more often supervised. Actually, a high proportion of people in one survey used the injection site. So it would be one of a series of tools that this task force recommended. And because I think people are really feeling that injection drug users are stigmatized and they're not well understood, they are not wanting to have this kind of a program in the King County area. And they tend to be the same people who fight against environmental science, people who, I guess, are not convinced by any kind of science and don't find themselves convinced by the opinions of public health experts. So they would like to basically tire hands of the public health folks and not allow them to establish these programs, which we think are one of the tools that really ought to be enabled in places around the country where injection drug use is really problematic.
Dr. Wood, before we talk about the initiative and your effort to stop the vote, could you talk a bit more about these supervised consumption facilities, safe injection sites? There have been a number of different names. In addition to Insight up in Vancouver, there's a long-running supervised consumption facility at King's Cross in Australia, in Sydney. Several in Europe, and we're looking at a few
38 cities around the country, or around the world, rather. So it's not just Vancouver. It really is a series of countries that have come to the conclusion that these kinds of programs are important. I think they show that the populace and the government cares about these people. They offer not only education about how to be safer in injecting so as not to spread diseases like hepatitis C and HIV. Hepatitis C already is so prevalent in injection drug users that it's so important for them to be careful. Not everybody is going to want to stop using right off the bat, but the sites are also an opportunity to develop relationships with people and to help them get into treatment. It's been shown in Vancouver that is one of its major benefits, is getting people into treatment and also reducing overdose deaths. Because if somebody overdoses in the site, he's right there, a nurse is there, somebody can administer naloxone or something and keep the person alive. So until people are ready to stop using and get treatment, you know, these kinds of programs are very helpful to keep them alive and to try to keep them safe.
Harm reduction ought to be a no-brainer, yet you do have people, this Initiative 27, and as I understand, it's qualified for the ballot there. So tell me about the challenge that you filed.
Well, I'm not an attorney. I'm on this group because of my medical expertise, my public health experience, having established needle exchange programs here, which is a very similar sort of issue. And I'm not sure exactly what the legal steps are going to be. I think it's headed for the King County Superior Court. And the challenge is it legal for these kinds of initiatives to undo the work of expert boards and community panels and basically tie the hands of public health around recommendations that are based on evidence and expert opinion? We don't think that should be legal. We don't think that's the purpose of the initiative process. And it's my understanding that the attorneys think there's a good chance that we will say that these kinds of initiatives that also might impact vaccine rules and STD treatment shouldn't be in the hands of initiatives.
Again, speaking to Dr. Bob Wood, formerly the director of the HIV/AIDS program at Public Health Seattle in King County, now retired and a member of Protect Public Health. Dr. Wood, any closing thoughts for our listeners?
No, I think it's an important precedent for us to fight against. I don't know whether that's happened in other jurisdictions where there have been ballot initiatives that have tried to undo specific programs that might have been controversial. But I don't think it's a good idea, and I think it jeopardizes public health. It's sort of akin to asking people to vote on how you should be treated for heart disease or kidney disease.
To be
directed by experts with an evidentiary base.
Does Protect Public Health have a website yet, somewhere where people can go for information?
I don't think we do. We just got off the ground today, just filed the existence of our organization with the state, I think, over the weekend, and just announced today that we intend to try to undo this Initiative 27.
I wish you the best of luck, and thank you.
Well, you're my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, folks, been speaking with Dr. Bob Wood with the organization Protect Public Health in King County, Seattle, Washington. This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
Dick Gregory, one of our country's greatest political comedians, died Saturday at the age of 84. Starting out as a stand-up more interested in laughs than politics, Gregory's act evolved along with the growth of the civil rights movement in the 60s. Initially, Gregory believed that, quote, humor can no more find the solution to race problems than it can cure cancer, but that didn't stop him from talking about the most pressing racial issues of that era. He was considered a breakthrough performer in his ability to reach a white audience compared to earlier black comedians such as Red Fox and Moms Mabley, whose acts were confined to predominantly black clubs on the so-called Chitlin' Circuit. Gregory was especially successful at channeling his anger at the injustices of the day into satire about America's racial divide. For example, he would say, "Segregation's not all bad. Have you ever heard of a collision where the people in the back of the bus got hurt?" Gregory grew up poor and fatherless in St. Louis and soon learned that his jokes gave him power and influence. As he wrote in a memoir in 1964, quote, "They were going to laugh anyway, but if I made the jokes, they'd laugh with me instead of at me. After a while, I could say anything I wanted. I got a reputation as a funny man, and then I started to turn the jokes on them." Gregory was also a lifelong social activist, beginning with a 1962 demonstration in Mississippi for black voting rights. As a nonviolent protester, he endured numerous arrests and even a few beatings. Gregory ran for mayor of Chicago in 1967 and for U.S. president a year later on the Freedom and Peace Party ticket. His participation in hunger strikes for causes such as opposition to police brutality, nuclear power, the Vietnam War, and South African apartheid led him to become a strong advocate for healthy eating in his later years. Throughout his long career as a performer and activist, he never wavered from his values and principles. Certainly an impressive and increasingly rare achievement. In the words of fellow civil rights activist, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, quote, "He taught us how to laugh. He taught us how to fight. He taught us how to live. Dick Gregory was committed to justice. I miss him already."
Another great American comedian passed away this weekend. Jerry Lewis, a legendary entertainer and filmmaker, died Sunday at his home in Las Vegas at the age of 91. Lewis first gained fame for his nightclub act with singer Dean Martin, who acted as straight man to Lewis's clowning, starting in 1946. After the act ended in the mid-50s, Lewis went solo and became a popular director, actor, and screenwriter in movies such as The Bellboy, The Errand Boy, The Nutty Professor, The Patsy, and The Disorderly Orderly. Known as a great innovator, Lewis was never awarded an Oscar for his film work, though he received the Jean Hersholt Humanitarian Award for his charitable activity in 2009. His many other honors include 2 stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, one for his movie work, the other for television, and an induction into the French Legion of Honor in 2006. Lewis was also well known for his charity work, raising millions of dollars for muscular dystrophy research through his annual telethons, which began airing on Labor Day weekend in 1966, with Lewis continuing to host until 2010.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Seattle Hemp Fest, which was held last weekend. At 6, it's Labor Radio, radio of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class, followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, clear, with a low around 63, north-northwest wind 5 to 11 miles per hour. Tomorrow is expected to be sunny, no eclipse, with a high near 86. Today in history, in 1831, Nat Turner, an enslaved African-American in Southampton, Virginia, launched a rebellion with a small group of fellow slaves. They killed between 50 and 60 white people before being captured, and in 1983, Philippine opposition leader Benigno Aquino Jr. was assassinated by a member of the Philippine military, acting on orders from that country's dictator, Ferdinand Marcos. The quote of the day is from the late Dick Gregory, who said, "In the U.S., the Constitution is a health chart left by the founding fathers, which shows whether or not the body politic is in good health. If the national body is found to be in poor health, the founding fathers also left a prescription for the restoration of health, and that's called the Declaration of Independence."
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Missouri workers have stopped the anti-union right-to-work law there in its tracks. Passed by a Republican-dominated legislature, the anti-worker law attacking union finances was set to take effect August 28th. But thanks to a ballot initiative petition drive, labor delivered enough signatures to block the law. The question will now be on the state ballot in Missouri in 2018. Mike Lewis is president of the Missouri AFL-CIO.
We've done a long process of making sure people understand exactly what right to work does, which is cut wages, reduce benefits, make more unsafe working conditions for everyone, not just those covered under a collective bargaining agreement, but for everyone across the state.
Lewis says Missouri's people oppose the anti-union law Republicans call right to work.
The working people of Missouri fully understand the implications of what a bad law right to work really is. We voted it down in 78. There was a threat to put it on the ballot by the legislature again in 1986, and we had a governor stand on the front steps of the Capitol at a rally in 86 and tell us that if he had anything to do with it, right to work would never be on the ballot again because Missouri does not like right to work.
UAW Local 6000 in Michigan is gearing up to resist an effort by the state to further restrict state worker collective bargaining. Local 6000 is strongly against the civil service collective bargaining rule changes and is urging all UAW members to attend a Civil Service Commission meeting in Michigan September 20th. The UAW International is helping the local mobilize against the collective bargaining restrictions. GOP Governor Snyder's administration wants to end collective bargaining for state workers over how overtime is paid, how workers are reassigned after layoffs, and how performance pay is determined. The state also wants to give the Civil Service Commission power to change rules for employees, even while negotiated contracts are in effect. The news is brought to you by IMPACT, the Iron Worker Management Progressive Action Cooperative Trust. IMPACT's mission is more jobs for contractors and for iron worker members. You can become an iron worker in Washtenaw Community College's pre-apprenticeship program. Finish 24 credits at your own pace and become an iron worker Local 25 apprentice. Earn while you learn. Apply now at wccnet.edu.iron. That's wccnet.edu.iron. WIN is America's multimedia voice for workers. Support that mission at workersindependentnews.com. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
Roger Stone Jr. is a longtime Republican operative who started his career with Richard Nixon's committee to reelect the president. Stone was a senior campaign aide to the current president and has recently been acting as an apologist for the president in the aftermath of Charlottesville. He's also become involved in the new legal marijuana industry. Numerous drug policy activists and marijuana-related businesses are outraged that Stone's a keynote speaker at an upcoming marijuana industry conference, the Cannabis World Conference and Business Expo. Several prominent individuals and businesses have withdrawn from the conference in response, and a petition on change.org has been started to convince conference organizers to drop Stone from their lineup. KBOO's Doug McVeigh spoke with Betty Aldworth, Executive Director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, about the hashtag Disown Stone campaign.
Betty, what were you doing today? Today I got to take a day off from organizing activists, which is how I usually spend my days, to actually do some hands-on activism myself, working with Amanda and a handful of other extraordinary women, Wanda James, Shalene Title, Lauren Padgett, and Leah Heiss, to develop a very specific action for the Cannabis World Congress and Business Expo to oppose Roger Stone's presence by encouraging people to either, you know, if they have to go, to engage in some direct action while they're there. And if they are able, if that's the choice that they'd like to make, to withdraw from participation in the conference. We wound up with, you know, a large number of supporters, speakers, and sponsors on the sign-on letter that we created.
Hold on. Sorry for that, but a train just interrupted us.
You know, we started a private conversation a couple of days ago, really frustrated with the situation, and decided to take the matter into our own hands and develop an action. I'm really delighted to say that we've received a great deal of support from the cannabis industry. And let's be very specific about this. Roger Stone has, for many, many, many years, made comments that are so incendiary, so inflammatory, personally attacking women, people of color, Jews, members of the LGBTIQ community, and others, that are so offensive and horrifying and dehumanizing that he is not even allowed on CNN. He's been banned from CNN for years. And listen, I'm as much of an advocate for free speech as anybody else. However, that doesn't mean we need to give everybody a platform. And in the cannabis community, what we're doing here is trying to undo some of the harms of the war on drugs. The war on drugs, which is unabashedly racist. The war on drugs, which has been used to marginalize precisely those people who Roger Stone marginalizes on the day-to-day. And we released an open letter this afternoon to the CWCBE to ask them to not give Roger Stone that platform, and to let them know that if they choose to go through that with that, that there will be direct action at their conference, and that there, you know, there will be people standing up for what is right and decent in this world, which is equity, which is human rights and respect. And this man has undermined all of those values, all of those values that we should hold so dearly in the cannabis community, for decades. So I got to do a bunch of work today around putting that action together. We released it this afternoon. I hope that folks will head to Twitter or Facebook to search for the hashtag Just Say No to Hate. And you will find our petition. You can sign on as a cannabis consumer, as a member of the community, as a stakeholder here in what we're creating together. And, you know, make sure that people understand that the cannabis community ought to represent those values.
And all drug policy reform. I mean, it's like I said earlier, on main stage, we are part and parcel of the social justice movement. We're the bastard child of the social justice movement. But it's okay that it's not a specific drug policy thing, because there's a reason we're doing the drug policy. It's not an end of itself. We're not in this to go into business, and we're not in this as we want to get high. It's because it's a real issue, and it needs to be addressed. And it's times like that, it's things like this, I think, that kind of define that. Your thoughts on my rambles?
I think you're right, Doug. Like, you know, no matter what it is that brings us to this community, it might be about liberty, it might be about human rights, it might be about justice, it might be about racial justice. No matter what it is that brings us to this community, with just the tiniest bit of investigation, we're going to figure out that we've got to center our work around racial justice. We've got to make sure that we are centering our work around those who are most harmed by the war on drugs. And, you know, the cannabis industry, for all of its challenges and complications, receives an enormous pulpit from which they get to talk to people about cannabis and about how they want to build their industry. I don't think that it is unreasonable to demand that this industry, which is a gift from the activists who are here doing this work, you know, which is a byproduct, a complicated byproduct of human rights work fundamentally, I think it's incumbent on us to hold that industry accountable to the values that brought them there. That brought them here to where they are today. And that's what this is about. This is about making sure that people who espouse hate, people who regularly use the N-word and the C-word to describe prominent, brilliant members of communities who are speaking up for other people's rights, those people don't deserve a platform in our space. They just don't. And, you know, I think that we need to have a vibrant airing of, you know, ideas, discussions that are challenging, where we, you know, where we talk to each other and, you know, may or may not convince each other of our ideas and the reasons why we're here, our values and the rest of it. All of those conversations should absolutely be taking place, and I'm not asking everybody to agree with us. I'm not asking everybody to agree with me. But what I am asking is that we don't give space for hate.
Again, folks, been speaking with Betty Aldworth. You have several affiliations, but for the purpose of this interview, it's hashtag just say no to hate.
Yes.
And people can find that. Do you need a Facebook thing, too, or just say on Twitter?
Yep, Facebook or Twitter, just search that. It's a coalition of folks who are trying to do what's right and decent around this. And, certainly plenty of members of my organization, Students for Sensible Drug Policy, are supporting this. This is an individual effort where people, whether they be individual activists, whether they be cannabis consumers, leaders in the movement, leaders in the industry, or people who get to make decisions for their companies, are signing on to say that they won't stand for hate in this community.
Betty, thank you so much. Hashtag just say no to hate. Make that go trending.
That was a conversation with Betty Aldworth. Her new project to get the cannabis industry to live up to the values and the ideals of the marijuana legalization movement that created it.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
And now, from the Rick Smith Show and the Illinois Labor History Society, it's today's Labor History in 2 minutes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1893. That was the day that workers' rights and women's rights activist and anarchist Emma Goldman gave a speech in New York City. Emma Goldman was born in what is today Lithuania. She came to New York in 1885, where she built a reputation as a powerful speaker. In New York, she addressed a crowd of between 3,000 and 4,000 unemployed workers in Union Square. The country was at the beginning of a depression that would sweep across the nation. Working families were finding it harder and harder to put food on the table. By the end of 1893, unemployment would soar to nearly 20%. Undercover agents at the rally reported that Emma had urged the crowd to take bread from the capitalists, quote, by force. Goldman recounted saying, quote, "Well then, demonstrate before the palaces of the rich. Demand work. If they do not give you work, demand bread. If they deny you both, take bread." 10 days later, Emma was arrested in Philadelphia for her comments at the New York rally. She was sentenced to 1 year in prison. After she was released, Emma traveled to Vienna to study medicine. She returned to the United States to continue her lectures on workers' and women's rights. She spoke out about the need for women to have access to contraception, an opinion that could arouse a backlash at the time. Emma was arrested multiple times for daring to speak out on controversial issues. In 1919, during the height of the Red Scare anti-communist hysteria, Emma Goldman was deported to the Soviet Union. Emma was a courageous defender of free speech, often called the most dangerous woman in America.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Earlier today, the naval vessel USS John McCain was involved in a crash with a Liberian vessel off the coast of Singapore. The collision left 5 sailors dead and 10 others missing at sea. In response, the Navy has put its fleet on operational pause, and an investigation is now underway. This is the fourth crash involving a U.S. ship this year and the second in the past 2 months. Reports say the McCain was sailing east of Singapore when the warship collided with a commercial tanker. The McCain sustained damage to its left side. The tanker sustained damage to one of its tanks. No one on board the Liberian vessel was injured. U.S. military, as well as Singapore and Malaysian officials, are conducting search and rescue operations for the 10 missing sailors. Earlier this year in January, the USS Antietam ran aground near its home port of Yokosuka, and in May, the USS Lake Champion collided with a South Korean fishing vessel. Admiral John Richardson, chief of U.S. Naval Operations, released a statement that today's collision was, quote, "the final straw. We will conduct a more comprehensive review to ensure we get at the root causes of these accidents."
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Fox Wild, Linda Olson Osterlin, Ken Jones, and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk radio show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener calls. At 9, an alternative radio Yes Magazine co-founder David Corton asks what it will take to lead us toward an ecological civilization. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, tune in for Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, D-May Roberts checks in with Damaso Rodriguez about their upcoming season, including the controversial play An Octoroon. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Eric Bartels welcomes Scott Campbell, who was once known as Extremo the Clown, the offbeat character who ran for mayor and created absurd art cars, but he's also a talented splash painter whose work has adorned local storefronts for decades. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. KBOO keeps you informed and involved, and we need your help. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Good night, Rosalind. Good night, Danielle.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Last weekend, the 26th annual Seattle Hemp Fest took place up in Seattle. I was there as one of dozens of speakers from around the country talking about marijuana legalization, drug policy reform, and social justice.
The classic stereotype image, right? It's lazy, stupid, disrespectful. These are racist stereotypes. It's rooted in racism. It's not stated out loud, but it is coded. It's not just a way of mockery. It's also a very unsubtle message that if you smoke pot, see, if you smoke pot, we're going to start, we, the public, the society, you know, the powers that be, we're going to start thinking of you just like we think of the blacks and the Latinos. And you know what? We might even start treating you like we treat the blacks and the Latinos. That's the threat. That's the code. It's coded. See, that's we understand now this whole dog whistle politics. We don't necessarily hear people coming out to say exactly what they mean. They talk in code. So that was the warning in all that. Now, we've worked pretty well at getting rid of that stereotype, and it's because of people like Mickey Norris and the Cannabis Consumers Campaign, frankly, that we've been able to really dispel that. We could always say it's not true. Of course it's not true. It's never been true. We knew that stereotype wasn't true. We knew it because we're all pot smokers, and that's not us. But until the microphone went, there we go. But until we started, I'll try not to get loud, I promise. It's tough because this is a heavy thing. Until we started coming out of the closet and saying that we are not that stereotype, then, well, people are just going to believe what they believe. And you see, it's not a question of convincing the prohibitionists that they're wrong, because we're not going to convince you. You can talk to a refrigerator all that you want. You know, the light comes on, the light comes off, and the door opens and shuts. It's not going to listen to you. But the public who is watching that debate, who's listening to that debate, that's who they're trying to convince. So maybe we need to think about convincing that general public too. So by coming out of the closet and showing people that I'm a pot smoker, I'm an active, motivated individual who gets stuff done, that stereotype is a lie. That's how that stuff happens. Coming out of the closet did that. Now there's another stereotype that's going around, and this is huge. People like Kevin Sabet and others are pushing this image that, you see, they used to say, we just want legalization so you can get high. Well, obviously not. Like I say, came out of the closet and proved that. Now they're saying another thing. You just want legalization so you can make a greasy buck. You know, they're talking about us becoming the new big tobacco, big marijuana is going to be. And, you know, we play right into that when we talk about all the money and look at all the money. You're going to make so much money from this and, wow, check all this money. We're playing into that, you see. Now, I didn't get into this to make a greasy buck. I've walked away from some perfectly good and quite lucrative jobs because the politics were just like, I wasn't going to stay there anymore, or personal abuses from the bosses or some other kinds of stuff. I'm a nonprofit journalist. I scrape by, and, you know, it's just because I have a conscience. But you see, that's the point. I need to speak out and talk about that, and so do the rest of us. And it's not just about our personal situation. It's why we do this. You didn't do this so you could get high. You didn't start working on legalization. I sure didn't, because I thought it was going to make me $1 million. We're doing this because it's the right thing to do, because it's a smart thing to do, because it's what good policy should be. It's about social justice. I came out of the social justice movement. So do a lot of the other people doing this. And the people involved in HempFest, a lot of them are involved in social justice outside of marijuana politics. True of a lot of the activist friends we've got, the people who are really pushing this thing forward.
This next bit was Friday afternoon, main stage. First speaker is HempFest director Vivian McPeak. He'll do the introductions.
We are missing two stages. We're missing the 19-year Sealy stage this year and the EDM Starborn stage as well. So we're hurting, man, because nobody's putting money in the donation bins. $750,000 this cost to give it to you for free. And we've done it 25 years, so please kick down. You know, Tim Pate is the guy that's been up here for over 20 years with me, showing you what he's going to raffle off to all you guys for almost nothing. But he's not talking about that right now, because my brother's talking his other truths. Give it up to Seattle HempFest Corps member Tim Pate.
Thank you, Vivian, very much. Hello, folks. I have been with Seattle HempFest for a really, really long time, since 1995, actually. Before that, I ran the rock medicine team for the Grateful Dead from 88 until Jerry died in 1995. So this marks 30 years in a row that I've been helping put on some kind of public festival or another. And it's my privilege to help raise money and do all the things that I've tried to do over the years. But that's not what I want to stand here to tell you about right now. I live in Oregon, just a little ways down the road right here. For the last 5.5 years, I have been serving on the Administrative Rules Committee for Industrial Hemp for the state of Oregon. I help write the current regulations that govern our laws in Oregon. Now, I'm an old long-haired hippie, worked for the Grateful Dead, and I know that they didn't expect me to show up and be sitting next to the head of the Oregon State Police Drug Enforcement Division in committee with me. You know, and our state senators in committee with me, and our congressmen appointing me to the committee. But here I am, And I'm an old man in the committee. And everyone there pays attention to me because I'm the only one who walked in the room and understood what hemp was all about anyway. You know? And so now, 5.5 years later, we in Oregon have the most progressive available to a farmer regulations in the United States. So 2 years ago, we had 11 farmers get applications to grow hemp. And we had at least 5 different acres growing in Oregon. Last year, we had 75 acres. This year, we have 200 applications and 3,000 acres of industrial hemp growing in Oregon. Now, I got to tell you, you can see that if that was charted out, that'd be exponential growth. And we ain't stopping there. I promise you, we are not going to stop because we know that industrial hemp has the ability to grow so much more available raw material for us to work with than any forest in the Northwest United States. And even though they are the most productive forests on the planet, they don't even hold a candle to industrial hemp. And so what we're going to do is we're going to make non-toxic building materials out of industrial hemp. And we're not going to stop because I know there are people who would love to have houses that are not toxic to them. And I think that's a very important thing. When you have the ability to change the world, even though it's just you, take that chance. That's why I'm here to say that to you right now. I took that chance years ago when the congressman said, would you like to be on this committee? And I said, yeah, I do. I will. Abraham Lincoln said a long time ago that the best way to create the future is to change it yourself. And that's what you have to do. I'm asking every one of you here, because I'm an old man, I'm tired. I've been raising money a long time. I don't know how much more I can do this. I need you to step in and do it for me soon. I need you to become the activist that you really want to be. I want you to show all of your friends why this is important to you. And never quit, never give up. Never think that we can't be victorious because we have been and will always remain on the right side of this question. If it's a moral question, trust me, you are on the right side of morality. What you're doing right now, just the fact that you are here, I want to say thank you. I want to say God bless you. And I want to say keep up the good work because your presence shows you believe in what we are doing. So thank you very much.
My good brother, Tim Pate. Ben Livingston, the CEO of Cannazoning, is a dedicated activist for cannabis for over 20 years. Ben was the yard sign coordinator for Washington's 1998 Medical Cannabis Initiative and the Treasurer for Saddle I-75 that made marijuana the city's lowest police priority. He co-founded an activist cooperative focused on sending courtroom observers to cannabis trials. In 2013, the city issued him the first ever permit for a cannabis consumption space at Seattle Center. He wrote the pot column for The Stranger, reviews vaporizers for the cannabis, and now develops Cannazoning to help locate compliant cannabis real estate. What it doesn't say on this introduction is that Ben was also a long, long time HempFest core member, and he did so much to make HempFest the spectacular event it is right now. He did so much. Give it up to Ben Livingston.
Hello, HempFest. Quick question. Do you like cannabis?
Yeah.
Right. A little lukewarm. Well, what kind? Indica, sativa? Did I hear both? The correct answer is actually both. There's going to be a test tomorrow and the next day. Remember. I want to kind of follow up on in the vein that Tim's talking about. I try to think about what I can tell people to leave them with that's more useful than just telling about what I've done in my life. And what I frequently come to is I believe that we make our own reality and we start that in our heads. That ultimately begins in our mind and that ultimately ends in our mind. And this is probably really good to be talking about after 420, so I think you can feel this a little more deeply. But the reason cannabis is legal is because we thought it should be legal we thought it is legal. And that's, you know, there's some more mechanics to it. It's maybe not quite that simple, but ultimately that's the reason cannabis is legal. It starts in our heads. So we, you, I, make our own reality. And that's one thing I want to say very basically. The other is, you know, put your flag in the wind. You know, if you're interested in getting involved, get involved. There's all kinds of opportunities out there. After my path was that I was a cannabis activist for a long time before we legalized cannabis. That's just my path. There's all kinds of other folks out there who have different paths. You don't have to be on that path, but there are so many opportunities. After we legalized cannabis, I was writing for The Stranger for a while. I started reviewing paraphernalia for The Cannabis, which is actually a publication of the Denver Post. And I would have never thought when I was a cannabis activist before we legalized pot, first that there would be a position that the Denver Post would have someone reviewing bongs, and second that that would be me. And that just happened because I stuck my flag out. I said, yo, Ricardo, I'm in Seattle. You need some writing? And he said, well, you want to review bongs? I said, I have no idea. I've never done that. But whatever, man. That's the path in? Sure. And so I stuck my flag out there. And I just, you know, there's all kinds of opportunity. And if you don't want to be in the cannabis industry, that's totally fine. And maybe even that's better. I tell you what, man. All kinds of jobs outside of the cannabis industry have way better benefits. Like, your mom's going to be way more proud if you get a job in the tech industry. So don't feel like you got to get a job any particular place or got to put your, you know, stake your flag anywhere. But just know that that's an option for you, that opportunity exists there. And then the third thing I'll try to wrap up on is my dear friend Nora Callahan from the November Coalition taught me long ago that your activism is around you. It's where you stand. It's where you live. And so in my life, most of my activism has started from that, what I saw around me, things that I saw. I'm a member of a police accountability group with two other civil rights activists, and we've sued three police departments, including State Patrol, Seattle Police Department, and the Tacoma Police Department, and we actually won in court against the Tacoma Police Department. And all these, this journey for me started from a personal ticket that I got where they basically wouldn't give me video when I went to court. And that was just what I saw around me, and it sort of blossomed into something more where we've settled or won court cases against three major police departments and have, you know, $75,000 to work with on police accountability just because we started from where we stood and what we saw around us. So that's all I want to leave you with is, you know, your activism is where you stand. You make your own reality, and if you want to, put your flag out there, man. Try it out. See what happens. Get involved. Thanks a lot.
Love you, Ben.
You just heard Tim Pate and Ben Livingston, both longtime activists and reformers, speaking from main stage at Seattle Hempfest on Friday, August 18th. They were being introduced by Vivian McPeak.
Seattle Hempfest is usually held every year on the third full weekend of August. For more information about the event and to make plans for next year, check them out on the web at hempfest.org. For KBOO News, I'm Doug McVeigh.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of An Evening with Dan Levinson at Kennedy Violins on Saturday, August 26th at Kennedy Violins in Vancouver. His stage show, An Evening with Dan Levinson, is an intimate evening of musical conversation that combines old-time fiddle, Appalachian banjo, stories and song in a storytelling format to tell the story of life in rural Appalachia and life on the road. Again, that's An Evening with Dan Levinson at Kennedy Violins on Saturday, August 26th at 4 p.m. at Kennedy Violins, 508 Southeast 117th Avenue in Vancouver. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag Fuzzy Boo and you'll be entered to win a chance to have Fuzzy Boo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/fuzzyboo.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
The time is 6 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time for Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, Portland. This is Labor Radio. I am your host, Michael Cathcart. My co-host Nick Bubb is out of the country right now, so I will be doing this one solo tonight. I'd like to start by just giving a shout-out to the folks who are making their way back from Central Oregon. Looking at the map on my phone right now, it looks like there's still some pretty heavy traffic out there. So if you are listening in your car, sit back and we will take